This is the Breaker.News podcast for January 20th, 2019. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, regular features like the Is It Just Me commentary, headlines from around the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, the debut of Reporter's Notebook, an occasional feature in which I talk to a reporter about the story behind the story and I discuss issues impacting news coverage. The first guest is Brett Minear, the afternoon drive host of Radio NL in Kamloops, British Columbia. Brett and I discuss Transport Canada's new regulations for drones, and Brett talks about how he was threatened with assault and even death after a comment about a yellow vest protest that turned ugly in Kamloops. And on the Big Deal feature, I interview Swedish human rights activist Peter Dahlin after another busy week in China's war of words with Canada over the arrest of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou. And The Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to someone who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or what was Karen Wang thinking when she put that offending message out on WeChat, the Chinese social media platform? If you missed it, Wang appealed to Chinese voters, promoting her ethnicity and comparing it to Jagmeet Singh, who is Indo-Canadian. She was trying to rally voters in Burnaby South to support her Liberal candidacy in the February 25th by-election. Wang figured that 16,000 votes would be enough to beat the NDP leader, who parachuted in from Ontario. Wang tried the same tactic in the 2017 provincial election, but didn't directly compare herself to her opponent, Ann Kang, the winning NDP candidate who is originally from Taiwan. This time, Wang's party did not tolerate her tactics, and the Liberals sent her packing. She was replaced by Richard T. Lee, the former BC Liberal MLA from North Burnaby. Ethnicity does help to shape a person, but it should not be the be-all and end-all. Whoever wins an election must represent everyone, regardless of their demographics. In Canada, we do need people from all backgrounds to be engaged in politics and to run for parliament. We just don't need pandering, and we don't need identity politics. What do you think? Email me, bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the South China Morning Post, Frank Tang reports, "Not a single day of rest. Victims reveal details of being locked up and forced to work in China." After being locked up and forced to work in harsh conditions in northeast China for up to 6 years, 52 men were freed in April last year when one of them finally escaped and reported the case to police. The 13 men who ran the four syndicates that lured them into slavery were sentenced to jail terms of 1 to 6 years by a Harbin court in December. Shocking details have now emerged in the slavery case, with two of the victims telling their stories to Chinese news site thepaper.cn. The men are from provinces across China, but they all had one thing in common. They were struggling to find work because of physical disabilities, mental illness, a lack of education, or homelessness. The syndicates preyed on them as they looked for jobs in train stations or at labor markets, where rural migrant workers usually go to find employment in the city, the news outlet reported. They were taken to the northeast of the country, where they were locked up, and when they were not working, they were guarded by syndicate members around the clock. Their ID cards, mobile phones, and money were taken away, and the victims said if they tried to escape, they would be beaten with shovels and other tools. In the Japan Times, Magdalena Osumi reports, "Cherry blossoms in Japan are predicted to arrive earlier than usual again in 2019. Although some parts of Japan have yet to see this year's first snowfall, experts say they already know when spring will come. Last year, spring arrived surprisingly early across the country, with buds starting to appear in Tokyo on March 17th. In this year's forecast, released January 17th, Japan Meteorological Corp. announced the blossoming in Kochi is likely to be followed by early flowering in Fukuoka, where blossoms are due to emerge on March 20th. Soon after that, sakura flowers will begin to bloom in the cities of Tokyo and Nagoya on March 22nd, in Kyoto on March 25th, and Osaka on March 27th. The firm has concluded that relatively warm temperatures throughout the country over the months since October have delayed the tree's dormancy period, which allows sakura buds to survive the winter. But the delay to the start of the dormancy period is not expected to affect blooming, and the warm weather could even speed up the blooming process. According to the forecast, cherry trees will be in full bloom in Kochi on March 25th and in Tokyo and Fukuoka on March 29th. And for those keeping track here in Metro Vancouver, cherry blossoms are already on some trees in Richmond, where I actually saw a hummingbird on January 19th. You'll have to take my word for it because this is an audio podcast. And finally on stuff.co.nz, Esther Taunton reports, Hell Pizza offers unruly tourist pizza to a select few. The pizza chain doesn't often miss a marketing trick and is making the most of the interest around a disruptive British family traveling in New Zealand. A billboard at Victoria Park in Auckland announced the launch of the limited edition Unruly Tourist Pizza, which comes with a warning that it may contain hair and ants. The group of tourists have reportedly refused to pay for several restaurant meals during their stay, saying the food has been contaminated with hair and insects. Those not put off by that disclaimer still need to meet strict criteria to purchase the pizza, as terms and conditions state it will only be available to notorious families of rabble-rousers who have stolen a rope, crashed a beach, and received a deportation notice in the last 7 days. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Bellingham Herald, Key Relier reports, as federal shutdown spreads to Bellingham Coast Guard, more residents asking how to help. Whatcom County residents and businesses can help U.S. Coast Guard members who are working without pay because of the partial shutdown of the federal government. Just don't do it through a GoFundMe page because, as it turns out, members cannot accept donations that way. Donations could be seen as one person getting preferential treatment, and it's also a no-no because the agency provides law enforcement. But the Coast Guard isn't the only agency facing the GoFundMe ban. An estimated 42,000 active duty Coast Guard members are working without pay. Tuesday was the first time they didn't get their paychecks because of the ongoing shutdown. Other federal employees have gone longer without being paid during the shutdown that began December 22nd. In the Seattle Times, Jim Brunner reports, Washington Democratic Party chair on Howard Schultz presidential run. Just don't. News that former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz might run for president as an independent is not sitting well with the top Democratic official in his home state. Citing Schultz's claim that he's a lifelong Democrat, Tina Podlodowski said he should run as a Democrat, investing in the party's infrastructure. Quote, you can even start at home with the Washington State Democratic Party, she added, inviting Schultz to meet and work together to make our country better. The blowback shows Democrats' fears that an independent candidacy might only split the anti-Trump vote in 2020, securing the president's re-election. But it is also evidence that Schultz may have a hard time building support in his home state as a corporate executive who has not cultivated substantive political relationships. Of course, he's also remembered bitterly by Seattle basketball fans for his ill-fated tenure as owner of the Supersonics. After complaining about conditions at Key Arena and failing to persuade lawmakers to spend public money on an upgrade, Schultz and his co-owners sold the team to an Oklahoma City-based ownership group that moved the team there in 2008, renaming it the Thunder. And in the Breaker.News, we reported, Plekis's final straw was Clark's plan to politicize riding offices. After Darrell Plekis, who is now Speaker, challenged Christy Clark to quit as BC Liberal leader during the Penticton caucus retreat in July 2017, he prepared a news release that he eventually canceled when she did resign. The Breaker.News was first to report in August 2017 that Plekis was the catalyst for Clark's departure after he threatened to quit the party and sit as an independent over the ex-premier's leadership. The final straw for Plekis was Clark's idea for all BC Liberal MLAs to fire their nonpartisan constituency assistants and replace them with personnel who would willingly engage in political activities to bring down the NDP. The plan had been discussed at a post-election caucus meeting. Plekis called that an, quote, inappropriate view of public service employees' independence and the disrespect for public resources. My constituents expect me to represent their interests in an honest and forthright manner, and I cannot do that if my leader is calling on me to compromise my values and my integrity. End quote, said the unpublished news release that was obtained by the Breaker.News. Constituency offices, according to BC legislature rules, must be operated on a strictly nonpartisan basis and cannot be used to engage in or host partisan political activities. Plekis declined comment when contacted by the Breaker.News. The speaker is expected to offer details why Clerk Craig James and Sergeant at Arms Gary Lenz were suspended with pay in late November and put under RCMP investigation. Sources say the secretive legislature is rife with corruption. Also, go to thebreaker.news and read about the backlash by neighbors against the Capilano Suspension Bridge's proposal to tear down empty townhouses and put up a parking lot for 100 vehicles. Neighbors are already angry about summertime and Christmastime traffic congestion and pollution from the tourist attraction that draws 1.2 million visitors a year. And find out what BC Hydro internal auditors had to say about the disorganization of BC Hydro's smart meters program. Read those stories and more in the Breaker.News. On this edition of the Breaker.News podcast, we debut a new feature called Reporter's Notebook, in which we hear from a reporter about the story behind the story or an issue facing the media. On this edition, we feature Brett Minier, who is a host of the afternoon show on Radio NL in Kamloops, British Columbia. Brett is a drone pilot, and he weighs in with his thoughts on Transport Canada's newly announced regulations, which come into effect on June 1st. For drones from 250 grams to 25 kilograms, pilots must be certified as of June 1st. Drones must be registered with Transport Canada, and they cannot be flown more than 400 feet in the air. They must also be 30 meters from people and at least 5.6 kilometers from airports and 1.9 kilometers from helipads. I asked Brett Minier if this would mean better, safer drone pilots in Canada.
These new drone rules don't really solve the problem that they are wanting to fix, because the reality is anybody can go down to London Drugs or a Best Buy or whatever and buy a very, very advanced drone system. And, you know, you have to register it technically, but, who's checking to see that you did, right? The other thing about these rules is that, you know, they're not altogether very different in terms of altitude limits and that kind of thing. You know, safe distances from airports, the no-fly zones and all that, they're not that different than what was already in place. And as we know, people were breaking the rules all the time. I think without enforcement, these rules are pretty meaningless. I think that there's a lot of, just speaking for myself, I think that a lot of the rules around no-fly zones and exclusion zones around helipads and all of this kind of thing, I think that they are they're a little bit too restrictive. So there's going to be a lot of people that are probably routinely breaking them. And I think that we have a lot of these laws around so that when somebody is caught doing something stupid, there's an awful lot that they can throw at them. But in terms of it being sort of proactive and cutting down you know, incidents of close calls and that kind of thing, which is a whole other issue on its own, how much we want to, you know, how much credit we want to give some of the numbers on that. But I think that, honestly, people aren't, I think that the rules are a little bit heavy. People are going to be breaking them. And in a lot of ways, it's really hard to know all the time if you're near a helipad or anything like that. My experience around the province has actually been that when you go flying. You can be out in the middle of nowhere. So you think, okay, I'm in the lower mainland, for example. Okay, I'm free and clear of the YVR airspace of Pitt Meadows, of Boundary Bay, of Langley, of the little grass strip off of King George Highway in South Surrey. Awesome. But BC Hydro, for example, and the Canadian Coast Guard, they've got these little remote helipads up on mountaintops and all of this that there's no way that you can know that they're there unless you're out purchasing aeronautical charts and this kind of thing to find out where they are. The law also doesn't seem to make any distinction, say, between a grass landing strip that maybe sees one aircraft come in a year, and YVR that has thousands come in a day. And to me, that's a little bit ridiculous. There's a lot of countries out there where remote control airplane clubs actually fly at actual airfields, and they've got sort of agreements and protocols on how that works and how the two things can sort of share the airspace. But there's no such arrangements in Canada. It's just an outright no fly zone, and it's up to you as the operator to know where those are.
On another topic, Brett became the focus of the story. He commented about a Yellow Vest Canada protest in Kamloops that coincided with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's visit on January the 9th. Reporters from various outlets had been bullied and threatened by some of the protesters. Brett faced several days of online harassment for what he said. In Brett's case, both he and his wife were subject to threats on social media, threats of assault and threats of death from people, some anonymous, and others who use their real names.
It was a very busy and stressful day for newsrooms in town. And at the end of it all, a lot of us were reflecting and being like, who are all of these people that sort of came out of the woodwork? There was some pretty gross elements. I tweeted, okay, now keep in mind, as of August, my job description here changed. I went from being a reporter and an anchor to now being a talk show host, where now I'm quite literally paid for my opinion on things, right? So after I turned off the live stream of the Prime Minister's visit and just seeing what everything was devolving into there, I was grossed out, and I tweeted that having the Prime Minister come to town and seeing just what gross, terrible human beings are out among us with their delusional conspiracy theories, racism, disrespect, and total inability to engage in good faith conversation makes me want to get off this planet ASAP. And it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke. And, talking about gross and terrible human beings, I'm talking about the racists, the people who are associated with the soldiers and Wolves of Odin and other racist groups. And
Brett said that social media has often been seen as a place where religious fanatics are self-radicalized. He's worried that that's now happening among political activists, hyper-partisan political activists self-radicalizing on social media. He also said that a host from a competing radio station was so scared with threats that she did not go home.
So that was the thing. It's not anonymous. People were more than happy to put their names to it. And yet, even still, there's no accountability because the bar is pretty high for the police to go knock on your door for online harassment and all that. The bar is very high. Some say it's too high. I don't know how I feel about that because, I am a free speech kind of guy, but it is hard. Even in the case of my colleague up the hill, as far as I know, no arrests, nobody got a talking to from police or anything, and here she was out of her house for a night. Like, that's insane to me that somebody can do that and there's no consequences for it.
One of the individuals that posted offensive threats against Brett and his wife actually had a change of heart and contacted Brett.
After the worst of it had sort of passed, I actually, my cell phone rang one day. I was on the air. I couldn't take the call, but it was followed up by a direct message from Facebook. And this was an individual who was apologizing to me for his conduct. He said he was embarrassed. That he said the things he did. He said that when his wife saw the Global News report and saw his name in as one of the posters, saying vile things about my wife and myself. He said he got it from his wife, and rightly so. He said that it made him stop and think and consider the kind of websites that he reads, his social media habits, and all of this. And he says, "I'm truly sorry for what you went through, and I have to reevaluate my relationship with social media and all and the type of stuff I'm looking at. I consider myself a moral man. I dislike the policies of this prime minister. I'm very pro resources, but I clearly went too far. Sorry." So I didn't respond right away because I kind of was curious to know who he was. And he was actually the first individual on the Yellow Vest Canada page that actually brought my wife into it. So, you know, at first I got it and I was kind of, I was still sort of angry, but then I thought on it and I was, and then it turned to just being very touched that he had actually reached out. I think it takes somebody of pretty strong character to do that kind of a walk back, because it was a complete walk back. This guy totally apologized. He went above and beyond, and I just felt that it was a good example of that we can all be better if we all maybe just take our heads a little bit out of the swamp of social media and start acting like human beings would talk to each other face to face again.
That was my interview with Brett Menier of Radio NL in Kamloops, British Columbia, where he hosts the Afternoon Drive show. For more information or listen to Brett, go to radionl.com. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The war of words between China and Canada intensified last week. In December, China arbitrarily arrested businessman Michael Spavor and diplomat Michael Kovrig in retaliation for the arrest of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou at Vancouver International Airport. China also retried convicted drug smuggler Robert Schellenberg and increased his sentence from 15 years to death this week. Canada issued a travel warning about China. China reciprocated. Canada appealed for support from its allies. China's foreign ministry mocked that. China's ambassador Liu Xie threatened Canada with further trouble if it does not let Huawei build the 5G network in Canada. Meanwhile, Meng Wanzhou's father, Huawei founder Ren Zhengfei, said that Meng was well-treated by Canadian authorities before she was released on $10 million bail. I caught up with Peter Dalin to get his perspective on the week that was. Dalin is in Madrid. He runs Safeguard Defenders, a pan-Asian human rights organization that advocates for media and lawyers.
It's been a busy week, and I think we're going to see a lot more of this. I believe the Chinese realize that they've painted themselves into something of a corner here. Usually this kind of bullying tactics tend to work for the Chinese Communist Party. We've seen similar situations with Sweden not that long ago. And I think as far as they're concerned in terms of tactic and strategy, the resistance shown by Canada has taken them by surprise. And they will try to escalate this situation step by step until they can see that Canada is willing to sort of negotiate and sort of take the step to de-escalate the situation. Largely, Michael Kovrig and Spavor are tools by the Chinese side to try to force Canada to de-escalate the situation. And we're going to see them adding more and more such tools as long as Canada refuses. But we're also seeing in Chinese state media that the sort of the growth or even snowballing in support being issued for Canada by a growing list of nations. And now, of course, with some upcoming meetings that they are rattled. This is not at all what they expected. And I think they find themselves painted into a corner without any real options for how to deal with this at the moment.
Dalin, a Swedish human rights activist, was jailed in China for more than 3 weeks in early 2016 and subject to a false and forced confession before he was deported. At the time, he was working for Chinese Urgent Action Working Group. I asked Peter to describe what life was like for him in jail in China.
Most of what you remember really is that you are in a state of being disappeared rather than detained. And we see that with Michael Kovrig, we see that with Michael Spavor. in that they've been placed into something called residential surveillance at a designated location, which is a euphemism for disappearances, essentially. That means that the Canadian government is unaware of where they are being held, and of course, they are denied legal access, contact with their family, etc. It is my understanding from what we know that Michael Kovrig is almost certainly being held in the same facility that I myself was in, and several of my colleagues, and also my girlfriend. So I think I understand his position, his situation quite well. And one of the things that happens when you're in this so-called RSDL system is that you're kept in solitary confinement. So he spent most of his time sitting in a suicide-padded cell. And on a daily basis, he'll be led across the hallway to an interrogation room, locked into something called a tiger chair. And what we've heard is he goes through 4 hours of interrogation per day. My own experience was more 5 to 6 hours because they tend to work in 6-hour shifts. And this goes on sort of day by day. And what's interesting, of course, is that when you're inside the system, which can last for up to 6 months without any kind of court order, even the state prosecutor is regularly denied the right to visit to supervise. So for all of those victims that are Chinese lawyers, Chinese journalists, because they tend to be the kind of victims that end up in this system, physical and mental torture is somewhere beyond very common and almost guaranteed.
Darlene also talked about the work that Safeguard Defenders does.
Very much focused on the rule of law and those issues. We are not sort of a political group as such. So we deal largely with the legal community and how China chooses to implement or rather not implement their own laws and how we can highlight that on an international level. We quite recently saw that the United Nations, after some reporting that we've been doing for a while, have gone out and called on China to repel this system that Michael Kovrig and Spavor is in right now, the RSDL system. We've also tried to highlight the use of these so-called forced televised confessions that often takes place when people are awaiting arrest, awaiting trial, and often preceded by torture. And we believe that by highlighting such systems, we can also sort of try to limit their use. So we do what we can to try to highlight deficiencies in how China implements its own so-called system of rule of law.
That was my interview with Peter Dahlin, who joined me on Skype from Madrid. For more information, go to safeguarddefenders.com. Now it's time for Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the parents of Wills Hodgkinson of Penticton, BC. The boy was diagnosed with a cancerous tumor in his kidney last year. Now things are looking up for him after he was treated at BC Children's Hospital. So his parents are organizing a fundraiser for the hospital foundation to say thank you. 100 $100 tickets are available for a tour of luxury homes and dinner at a winery. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting. Find out more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for January 20th, 2019. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on January 20th in 1928, In Old Arizona was released? The Western was the first talking movie filmed outdoors. The Irving Cummins-directed feature starred Warner Baxter as the Cisco Kid. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.